All right, we are here on case 14-674, State versus Anderson. Counsel?
Chief Justice, and may it please the court. My name is Neil Agarwal. I represent David Anderson, and I request 3 months for rebuttal. Your Honor, the facts of this case are not in any dispute. Mr. Anderson kidnapped and raped an innocent woman and was sentenced to 17 years incarceration after going to trial, of which 10 years is a mandatory sentence for the rape and 7 years for the kidnapping. They were ordered to run consecutive for the total of 17 years. At sentencing, the trial judge, without request by either the victim or the state or even the defendant, imposed a no contact order between him and the victim. The terms and conditions of the no contact order was not specified, the length, the duration, who is prohibited from contacting, whether it be directly or indirectly, how to get it modified. None of that was specified. It was just an indefinite no contact between himself and the victim.
Did the prosecutor request the no contact order?
No,
at
Your
the
Honor.
Sentencing? This was sua sponte that the court did this.
Correct. It was a sua sponte order by the judge, probably based upon the heinous nature of the offense.
Was it done after the victim spoke at the sentencing?
Well, the victim herself did not speak. She had a friend of hers read a letter of her sentiments to the court. But yes, to answer your question, the judge imposed a no contact order at the very end of the sentencing hearing. Defendant appealed his conviction to the Court of Appeals, which affirmed his conviction in full and in sentence. And concerning the no contact order, the Court of Appeals agreed with the defendant that there's no law that allows a trial court to impose a no contact order. But then in the very next sentence, they said, however, there's no law that says they can't do it. Now, we dispute that concept of law for a number of reasons. The first is that this court just recently held in State versus Taylor, judges have no inherent power to create sentences. Rather, judges are duty-bound to apply sentencing laws as they are written. The only sentence which a trial court may impose is that provided for by statute. A court has no power to substitute a different sentence for that provided for by statute or one that is greater or lesser than provided for by law. In other words, there is no such thing as common law sentencing. If there is a provision under the sentencing code that would allow a no contact order, we would not be here for you today. If you ask the state what statute would allow a trial court to impose a no contact order, I don't think they'd be able to give you one. They didn't cite one in their brief. The trial court admitted the trial court did not cite one, and the Court of Appeals said there was not one.
Could the court do this if there were a request for a protection order?
It would, but it would not be part of this criminal case. A protection order is a separate, there's a civil procedure under the Ohio Code that allows anybody to request a civil protection order.
So that could be done.
Absolutely. If the victim is being harassed or threatened or feels intimidated, she, like anybody else, can file a petition with the court requesting a no-contact order with the defendant or anyone on his behalf, and the court would take testimony and make a determination. And there's absolutely nothing.
So the court has the inherent authority to do it. It's empowered to do it. But just your argument is just not in that venue. It had to be in a different venue.
Correct. As part of the sentencing, they cannot do it. But that is, I mean, the legislature has provided a remedy for one person to obtain a no contact against somebody else. And the victim still has those remedies available to her.
And those remedies are statutory.
Correct.
There's no inherent authority of the court, you're saying.
Correct.
Under those.
Could the court do it had it put Mr. Agarwal on probation? Could it do that as a condition of community control?
Yes. Under 29.
So it wouldn't need a separate civil action for that.
That is correct. Because when you put somebody on community control, he or she is still subject to the jurisdiction of the court. The person's still in the community and still has to comply with the probation officer and the terms and conditions.
So your argument is really the finality of the order of the court precludes this? Or are you arguing Are you arguing the court doesn't have authority to do it because it's not part of the sentencing statute?
That is what we're arguing. The court has no authority to impose a no-contact order because the legislature has not given them that authority.
You're saying no hybrid sentencing in this case. Prison was possible, but nothing else.
Correct. And in fact, the statutes specifically say under 2929.13, that is the statute for imposing a sentence, 2929.14 is for the terms of prison. If we would allow a trial court to impose no contact orders without authority of the legislature on the concept that there's no law against it, then there's no limitation for a trial court to impose all kinds of punishments. And I've cited in my brief,
is this a punishment?
It is a...
To preclude your client from having contact with this victim, where's the punishment there?
Well, it is a restriction on his liberty. Like, it would be...
On his liberty?
Absolutely. If he is trying to contact her, if he wants to apologize, he wants to make amends. And again, we're not talking about always a situation where it's a stranger. Husband and wife. We're talking about father, child. It could be... boyfriend, girlfriend, brother, sister. If the trial court says you cannot contact your wife, let's say it was a domestic violence, and the man committed domestic violence on his wife, and the wife testified at trial, it didn't happen, it was a mistake or whatever, and the judge says, well, I'm going to punish him, put him in prison for 18 months, and I'm going to impose a no contact order between you and, you know, and the defendant, and she goes, but I want contact with my husband, the trial judge could say, too bad. I mean, we're entitled, the judge can do it.
That's a pretty extreme example to give us.
Well, it's accurate, though, Your Honor. If we say...
No, that's not what we have here. We have
correct.
A victim who, by the statement that was read at the time of sentencing, is clearly a damaged woman as a result of the activity of your client.
Absolutely. And I'm not trying to insinuate this isn't a horrendous crime. Absolutely. But again, we're talking about what is the lawful authority of the judge. There's nothing that says the legislature could not impose, could not give the judges authority to do this. They have chosen not to do it. Now, in absence of legislative silence, a trial court cannot sua sponte determine the type of sentencing that it wants to impose.
Mr. Agarwal, that gets to a philosophical question here, and that that would apply to creative sentencing. Are you saying that the judge has no inherent authority to be creative in a sentence if it's not in the statute? I'm thinking, for example, let's say someone had committed a theft and the court was to order jewelry of the defendant, for example, turned over to restitute an individual. You could say that's not in the statute. The statute doesn't prohibit it, so the court should have the inherent authority to do it. That would be the argument.
Well, yes, except we would argue restitution is a part of the sentencing statutes. There is a statute that deals with...
So you would allow for that type of creative sentencing?
Well, not... I'm ordering... Restitution is to be paid. But the judge couldn't order that you dispose of your... And I gave examples where the trial courts have said, as part of your prison sentence or community control, you have to sell property, or you have to acquire property, or you have to not vote.
So is it the question of community control added to a prison term that you're objecting to, which would be no hybrid sentencing?
Well, yes. We're also saying that you cannot impose community control sanctions when you send someone to prison.
All right.
First of all, the statutes specify either at time of sentencing you impose a prison sentence or you impose community control sanctions. You can't do
right,
both.
And community control sanctions are listed within the statute.
Correct.
So, for example, if the court wanted to say, and you are going to write 30 essays for me within the next 6 months as part of community control. Now, that's not in the statute. It's not prohibited in the statute. It would be a community control sanction. Does the court have the inherent authority to order that as part of the sentence?
Well, under 2929.17, that deals with non-residential sanctions, such as day reporting, house arrest, community service, it says not limited to. It is a non-exhaustive list. And this court has held, if it's non-exhaustive, that means these aren't the limitations, that there's above and beyond, there are more things that could be imposed.
So the court has the inherent authority to be creative in sentencing as long as it's within the community control portion of the sentence? Is that what you're saying?
I wouldn't say it's inherent authority. I would say that's authority that's given by the legislature.
It's discretionary with the judge.
It's discretionary, as provided by statute.
Right. It allows the judge to exercise discretion on what an appropriate addendum to the or condition of community control might be. But if we're talking about a term of incarceration, what about the sentences where a judge says, on the day of the death of the victim that you caused, you will spend that day in solitary confinement every year for the next 25 years, or once a year, those type of sentences? They're not statutorily mandated.
Well, that exact issue has come up before, Your Honor, and the Court of Appeals has struck down those conditions of confinement.
The Ninth District has?
Yes, the Ninth District. That would be like saying this prisoner has to wear pink in the prison. He has to have everyone else can have a 12 by 12 foot cell, but he has to have a 6 foot by 6 foot cell. I mean, there's no limitation that a trial court could impose if we're saying they have the inherent authority when you send them to prison. This court has already held there is no such thing as common law sentencing. Further, it's a separation of powers. The Department of Corrections already has statutes on the books that allows the victim here to just contact the prison and say, I don't want contact, done. I mean, it's not a very onerous burden. It's not difficult in any way. But to somehow say, well, the judge is going to do it, and then the cost, Your Honor, I think the state is saying, well, it's meaningless because the prison officials, but either it has meaning or it doesn't. Either he has if he violates, is it a contempt? Would he have a trial? Would we bring him to whatever county it occurred in? Would we give him an attorney, an appeal, a transcripts? I mean, the cost would be enormous. We have regulations. We have rules that would already prohibit this. There's nothing that she could not, the victim could not use to utilize this. So, in retrospect, Your Honor, I'd like to reserve the balance of my time, and we had asked the court to reverse the Ninth District. Thank you.
Ms. Guerrieri?
Chief Justice O'Connor, and may it please the court, my name is Natasha Guerrieri, and I represent the appellee of the state of Ohio on this matter. And the state would request that this honorable court uphold the finding of the Ninth District that a trial court may in fact impose a no-contact order between an offender and his or her victim when it is also sentencing that offender to a term of imprisonment. The trial court must consider those specific two overriding statutes of sentencing before imposing a sentence upon an offender. And that is to protect the public from the offender committing further crime and other offenders, as well as imposing the least restrictive sanctions available to accomplish those goals without placing an unnecessary burden upon state or local governmental resources. And within those 29-29-11 and 29-29-12, there is reference to the fact that the trial court should, in fact, consider the impact upon the victim when imposing sentence.
But those are all the purposes of sentencing. That's the overall philosophy that a judge is to consider in choosing a sentence. Where is there, within the prison option that the judge is given, the ability to impose a no-contact order?
The state could not point to a specific statute that actually addresses no-contact orders, either through the prison portion of the sentencing statutes or any other statute section with regard to sentencing. There's no specific reference to no-contact orders. However, in those overlying principled statutes, it does allow a trial court discretion in determining the most effective way in which to implement those overriding principles of sentencing. And that's kind of where the state is resting its hat with regard to the no-contact orders, that the court is able to take into consideration victims and the impact that it has had upon the victims, those crimes, in determining whether or not no contact orders are appropriate.
Counsel, don't you have a kind of a conflict on your side of the house here? It seems to me the 8th District Court of Appeals in Cuyahoga says the state of Ohio accomplishes everything you're saying through the Adult Parole Authority. That when they release somebody, they can issue a no contact. They can do a lot of things, can they not?
You are correct, Your Honor. They definitely can.
So how do we address the conflict? The 8th District seems to say this will happen later and there's no statutory authority for it to happen now.
Your Honor, and really it's what the state would argue is that the trial court, in imposing the no contact order, in particular, in this particular situation, for example, the victim did in fact inform the court of the impact and all of the things that had resulted as a result of this particular crime placed upon her. And as the 9th District stated, the trial court is basically putting the prison system on notice of the victim's desire not to have contact with her offender. And it's just basically having a different source putting the prison system on notice of that.
The reality is that notice follows the prisoner through the prison system anyhow in the victim impact statement, does it not? I don't think anybody's getting out of prison in Ohio without the APA taking a look at what the victim said, are they?
That is correct. The victim does in fact have the ability and is encouraged to, and they do seek out information from the victim when he is being reviewed and when he's going to be placed upon post-release control. So that's definitely a mechanism in which the prison system would have that available to them. But the state would just argue that it's just a notice. It's notice to the prison system of the victim's desires, rather than having the victim have to, in fact, contact the prison system on their own. It's just a different way of informing them of that right, of that desire.
But the order said you shall have no contact with the victim. I mean, the order was directed to the defendant as an element of the sentence, correct?
Yes, it was included within the sentence, Your Honor. It did state that the defendant was to have no contact with the victim. And that was, as Attorney Agarwal stated, was toward the end of the sentencing hearing that was placed upon the record.
Well, when the case was presented to the appellate court, was the state's position that the trial court did error in this provision, or did I misunderstand that?
You did not misunderstand that, Your Honor. The state initially, relying upon the authority of the 3rd, the 8th, and the 12th District, did concede error with regard to the trial
condition
court's imposition
of no contact.
Of the no contact order, correct, Your Honor.
Okay, and so you're here now because the court disagreed with that analysis, and you're defending the 9th District on the conflict between that court and the other courts that have decided the case differently.
Correct, Your Honor. Correct, Your Honor.
All right.
And the state would submit that, in fact, this is not an encroachment upon the separation of powers issue, because, in fact, the trial court is basically just putting the prison system on notice. They're not dictating as to how, in fact, the prison system is to regulate the order, that there is a system in place with which the prison system can, in fact, implement the order of the court. And because there is that system in place, that there's no additional burden placed upon the prison system, because they already have rules and regulations with which to deal with this type of situation.
And are they always triggered by an order from the court? If the system internally has the ability to preclude, I would imagine, mail going out to the victim from the defendant or any other inappropriate communications coming in to that defendant, there is that screening process that's in place in the institution. Is that always triggered by a court order?
No, Your Honor. There are
what's the mechanism that usually makes that happen?
Correct, Your Honor, in which the victim or any other individual states that this particular offender is having unwanted contact, they can go through the mechanism of contacting the prison, letting them know that they do not want that contact.
Do you know of any other cases where a trial judge has done this and it's been upheld?
Not that I'm aware of, Your Honor, no.
Okay, which is why originally the state took a look at this and said, incorrect.
Exactly, Your Honor. That's exactly what the rationale was, is that the other three districts that in fact...
You would like us to look at it as the trial court speaking for the victim, even though the victim has the means through victim's assistance to do the same thing.
Correct, Your Honor. Because of the fact, in this particular set of circumstances, the victim did write a letter and did express the negative impact that this entire situation...
Well, understandable, and all victims have negative impacts. That's absolutely true, but I doubt whether the victim here wants to hear from this defendant. And there's ways of addressing this, even now, to preclude Anderson from, you know, sending her anything or contacting any way directly or indirectly. So it's not a situation that cannot happen. In other words, it's not a protection to be afforded the victim that cannot happen, and there's avenues in place to allow that to happen, both in the institution and, you know, through the victim's assistance programs, et cetera. Question is whether the court was on the right page by doing this on behalf of the victim.
And that is exactly the issue that is before this court, whether or not that the trial court did have that ability, and the state would submit that just based upon those overriding statutes and principles in sentencing, that the court was able to put the prison on notice of that desire of the victim.
Well, let me ask you about the example that I brought up with your opposing counsel, and that's when a judge says to a defendant that every day on the anniversary of the death of the victim, you're going to be in solitary confinement, or you're going to do such and such on that day. What do you think about that?
And as Attorney Agarwal stated, those have been previously struck down. But I would submit that that is a different situation than what we have here, because in those particular circumstances, the trial court is directing the prison system and how that sentence is going to be carried out. Whereas here, the prison system has that system in place. They're basically putting them on notice of the no contact and allowing them to regulate based upon the system that they already have in place.
Thank you.
Thank you. And I guess if there are no further questions, the state would request that this honorable court uphold the finding of the Ninth District Court of Appeals in this matter. Thank you.
Counsel, you have 3 minutes remaining.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court. Your Honor, in regard to your question earlier about the Ninth District and the spending in solitary confinement, I would cite to the dissenting opinion of Judge Belfant's paragraph 47, where she writes, "This court has previously concluded on more than one occasion that penalties that are not authorized by any statute are impermissible." And she cites two cases, State versus Moss, where she says that is concluding that banishment is not authorized as a permissible punishment, and State versus Creel, 2012 Ohio 3550, concluding that there's no statutory authority authorizing trial courts to order defendant to spend each Christmas Eve he spent in prison in solitary confinement.
Mr. Agarwal, that's an interesting approach and rebuttal that you raise, because I noticed in your brief you listed banishment, you listed no procreation, you listed denial of counsel, political activities, a whole series of conditions that trial courts have imposed, all of which have been struck down by appellate courts. Has this court ever spoken on any of those topics, according to your research?
No, Your Honor.
So is that something that we should think about in this case to instruct trial courts, or should we just limit this to a no contact in your view? And I guess the larger question is this something that's commonly misunderstood by trial courts? Because it seems to be, obviously in this instance, We have four appellate districts, the 3rd, the 8th, the 9th, and the 12th, have all had this issue.
Your Honor, you know, these are very emotional cases. Rapes, kidnappings, aggravated assaults, burglaries, and when you have a poor victim who's totally innocent, who's been victimized, it's very easy emotionally for a trial court to look at the victim, to sit through a trial, and say, you, defendant, will have no contact with this victim. And I think that is what's going on here, is that they're not thinking about necessarily, okay, what is the statute that I can look at to impose it? But then when you get to the Court of Appeals, they see the hard transcripts, they just see the words on the paper, and then they're looking at the code, and they say, it's not listed here, you cannot do it.
And you see that as a truly serious punishment, as opposed to the argument this is more like ordering restitution, that type of thing.
Well, if you remember, Your Honor, I cited in my supplemental brief, State versus Roper, there it was also a rape, but in there, the no contact order was not only with the victim, but with the victim's family. So now we're expanding no contact orders to not just that person, but to anybody the judge may impose.
Well, I'm still hung up on something you said early on, that your client, the defendant here, might want to have contact to make amends. How on earth does one make amends?
If I said that's not exactly what I meant. There's nothing my client can do that can make this poor victim whole. And I'm not going to suggest in any way.
Why would your client need contact? If he doesn't need it, why is the denial of it a punishment?
Well, like a lot of people, Your Honor, when you're sitting in prison, you reflect, you know, incarceration, you have a sense, try to get rehabilitated, you go through counseling, you go through treatment, and it's like AA meetings or NA meetings. One of the grounds is you make amends. And it's very possible, and I'm not saying he would, but you write a letter of apology. And again, I know the facts are to the egregious nature here, but the holding of the trial court or the appellate court is extremely broad and encompassing. We're not only going to do victim.
But that is not your case here. This is speculative. You're not saying that my client has a letter written and for his closure purposes or whatever he wants to attribute to this, he needs to make sure that this letter gets to the victim so his true remorse can be given to her. He had that opportunity at sentencing, did he not?
Sure. He also had that means by not committing the crime to begin with, too. I mean, I'm stuck with the facts that have been given to me. And if you look at the amicus brief by the Ohio Public Defenders, they've said that we think it's unlawful, too, for completely different reasons. One is where the victim wants to recant or has the ability to recant, where the defendant or the defendant's attorney contacts the victim and tries to get the conviction overturned, or for clemency. These would be impermissible if there's no contact order, because if we say no contact is direct contact, it could be indirect contact as well. That means through loved one, through your attorney, through a third party. So we're saying it's not limited to victims. It's not limited to just direct contact. What is the mens rea that has to be violated? It has to be intentional? Does it have to be knowingly, recklessly? What is the standard of evidence needed? Are we going to, again, the cost and burden for a trial judge to have to impose this would be enormous, because we'd have to transport the defendant up to the county where it occurred.
Can I clarify something, though? The no contact order in and of itself, if I heard you earlier, if there was a lower level felony where community control was an option, this could be imposed. A no contact order could be imposed as a non-residential sanction for a sentence of that type, correct?
Correct.
Under 29-2917.
Correct.
Okay, that's what I wanted to clarify.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Your Honor.
We'll take the matter under advisement. You'll be notified of our decision. Marshal, will you adjourn?
All rise. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. This open session of the Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio now stands adjourned.